people that knew him before and after say that the wound or the war or whatever caused a complete character change in him. That where prior to being injured, he was a hardworking, decent young man. He became very quarrelsome afterwards. He stole. He held up people. He slugged an officer at one time. And was constantly in trouble. When he deserted from the Army, and the Army hadn't found out he was the same one that had been in the Marines. But when he deserted from the Army, he then got little jobs as short order cook. And inconsequential jobs, but he was robbing others on the side. Cicchetti, who at the time of the trial was about 2 years older than Hunter, which would be about 20, Cicchetti would be about 27, had been a grifter all his life. He didn't go beyond grammar school. And from then on, he was commonly known as a hustler. He'd make a dollar any way he could, in card games, in by stealing, by con games, by working in circuses and carnivals, and working rackets in carnival. He ran a blind pig. He ran card games. Never had very much, but always managed to get by. Girl Evelyn and Hunter met in a restaurant on the east side of Detroit, where she was working as a waitress. He said that he knew people in Chicago, and he could make $125 a week if she'd go over there with him, and she could take it easy. Well, that was quite a bit of money then, particularly for a short order cook. She believed it and went with him to Chicago. The job didn't materialize. She worked, he stole, and got her to prostitute. Then, while they were in Chicago, they met Cicchetti, whom they had not known. And Cicchetti sort of idolized Hunter. And so, of course, did Evelyn. And the girl and Cicchetti began to hate each other. Of course, it was quite apparent that they were jealous over a Hunter. There was great animosity existed between them to such an extent that there was a little doubt in my mind, and it still is there, that Cicchetti actually went to the Jones home that night and participated in the robbery and murder. Now, I'm probably the only person in the state of Michigan who had that doubt. Everyone else thought he was there, but knowing how they hated each other and knowing that she sometimes went way out in place of imagination, and there she might have a motive to lie about Cicchetti to get him in more trouble. There is some doubt that, in my mind only, he was there. Well, getting back to the trial itself, it was pretty much of a bedlam. At one time, 50 uniformed police came rushing into the courtroom. It seemed that the prosecutor had been tipped off that some fictitious persons were going to liberate Cicchetti. This I don't believe at all. And asked for a few extra police, and the order got mixed up, and they sent about 50 Judge Gillis had to clear the courtroom several times of all standees because of the excitement. He'd have to send the jury out for a recess often until tempers cooled. And this went on for weeks, and each day seemed worse for the defendants, and as their chances seemed to be dropping, their tempers seemed to be getting greater. However, Hunter, after the first week or so, calmed down, and it was Ketty that was doing most of the yelling. It was the first trial I'd ever covered where the judge had to threaten to put the defendant in restraints. I know it's happened many times since that year, but it was quite unusual then. Well, as I say, it didn't take the jury long to deliberate. They found the two men guilty. Evelyn walked out of the courtroom free. And then the men were sent back to the county jail till the probation department completed its report, and they were sentenced on a Saturday morning. Now, it seems a little odd, quirk of our law, that there has to be a probation report, an investigation made before a person can be sentenced. When he's been convicted of first-degree murder and the sentence is mandatory, life in prison. But at any rate, it was. They knew what their sentence was going to be. And the first to be sentenced was Hunter, who made a very patriotic speech to Judge Gillis, in which he said that he fought and bled to protect the flag to which he pointed in the courtroom, that he was not guilty of murder, that the only thing he did was defend himself against the attack of Jones, and it was a great miscarriage of justice. He also reiterated that Sacchetti was not out there at the time, was completely innocent of any murder. Sacchetti then, when Judge Gillis turned to him and said, "Do you have anything to say before I pronounce sentence?" He said, "Yes, Judge, it's one alcoholic to another." And at that, there was an audible gasp in the courtroom. Judge Gillis had a reputation in some quarters of liking a drink now and then. And Sacchetti had told me one time that he lived in Detroit and he'd been fined $50 when he was arrested for running a blind pig, fined by Judge Gillis. And he happened, but Judge Gillis didn't remember it, and naturally he wouldn't. But as one alcoholic to another is not a very good opening. Then he continued by saying that he wasn't there, asked to the witnesses, lied, particularly Evelyn, wanted a new trial to start right then and there, but life sentence was pronounced. They were sent to separate prisons. Hunter was sent to Marquette, Sacchetti to Jackson. And after Sacchetti had been in Jackson about 2 months, he started a riot in the dining hall by throwing a plate of spaghetti and yelling it was lousy. He got several other prisoners to join him, and the guards quickly put the thing down. Sacchetti was injured, had a broken arm, and was shortly thereafter transferred to Marquette, which is the Siberia of Michigan, and that's where considered a pretty rough prison. So he was sent there. Now they both died. I used to hear from them regularly, yet always had a Christmas card from both of them. and occasional letters and cards. And they got, I'll check it, several years later, they were granted their appeal for a new trial was granted by the Supreme Court, and they were back in Detroit, Hunter, and he died in receiving hospital. Segetti died in Marquette prison, or Marquette, before the new trials were held. We can change that if it's...
Ray, let me ask you some questions about the trial and the case. You mentioned that Evelyn had lost custody of her children. Had that happened before she took up with Hunter?
Yes, happened before she took up with Hunter, and I might, this probably is a good time to put in that after the trial, she married someone, a man who had a very good reputation, was a factory worker in a city outside of Detroit, and probate court gave the children back to her.
Now, Hunter had an unusual explanation or version of the killing, didn't he? Could you go into some detail on that?
He said that Evelyn wanted to talk to Jones and went into a bedroom with him. And he called out, come on, let's go. He, Hunter. He got tired of waiting. And finally, he went in the bedroom, and she was committing what the police refer to in police reports as an act of oral perversion on, that is, Jones was committing what the police and police reports refer to as an act of oral perversion on Evelyn. And then the two men got fighting over that. But he said that Hunter testified that Jones had a gun, and he had to take the gun away from him, and he had to tie him up to keep him from continuing the attack, but he did not think he had killed him at all. He thought he had just knocked him out at one time. And impulsively, and that's his word, he took a diamond ring off Jones' finger, and the ring had been appraised at about $1,200, and Hunter said in court that the Chicago police stole it from him when he was in custody in Chicago after his arrest there. So the ring, the diamond, was never found.
I take it his story not only was disbelieved by the jury, but offended them.
Yeah, it offended the jury. It was obvious, a jury of all women. What he said about this innocent appearing girl, I mean, and Evelyn gave that impression and of being friendly and just easily led. And also the old man with a very good reputation offended them and just seemed unbelievable to even the fellows at the press table. Heard a lot of stories in her day. It seemed just an unbelievable story to everybody.
Now, Sicchetti claimed an alibi, didn't he?
Yeah, he said he was drinking whiskey sours during that time in a bar on Grand River, downtown Detroit. And he also had a couple of other bars, most of the time in that one. Well, I personally made an effort, and I know the police did, to check that out. And none of us ever was able to find a bartender or anyone else who recalled his being in any of the saloons he said he'd been in and drinking whiskey sours at all. And that, it would be a little unusual for one person to sit alone for a couple of hours, as he said he did in one bar, and drink whiskey sours. But nobody remembered it.
Now, did Evelyn, Larry's aunt, contribute any testimony?
And she only testified that she had a telephone call from Evelyn the day before the murder, and then Evelyn said she was in Detroit with Hunter, and she wanted some money. The aunt said she didn't have any, and then Evelyn asked her if she knew any rich man that Evelyn could get some money from. The aunt said no, she didn't. And the aunt knew also that Evelyn had been in Chicago, and assumed when she didn't hear from her again that she went back to Chicago, and assumed rightly, because that's where they went.
There was some question, Ray, about verifying the cab ride to the Ashland address. What was the problem?
Well, you see, every cab driver keeps, or is supposed to keep, usually does, a run sheet. Now, they rode, according to their testimony, in three cabs that night. A cab out to Ashland Avenue, a cab from Ashland and Jefferson back to the Griswold Hotel, which was unlocated on Grand River and Griswold. And then another cab from there over at the Teller Hotel. And the police testified, they went all through the run sheets of the cab company. They said they rode in checkers and could not find any such runs at all, which led me, made me wonder if maybe some unscrupulous cop found the run sheet. But the run sheet just said two passengers instead of three. I don't think that could happen. I don't think it did happen. But it seems strange that they couldn't find a record of any one of the three cab rides they took.
Well, now, it was agreed that the cab which took the two or three defendants to Ashland was dismissed when they went into the house.
Yes.
Is it plausible that having committed a murder or a homicide, they would take a cab back?
They walked over. No, they didn't. The testimony was they walked over to Jefferson and then a block west and picked up a cruising cab. And then they went to the Griswold Hotel. So there wasn't anything to link them to that address with the second cab driver.
Was there any question about the presence or absence of fingerprints in the house? I'm thinking particularly of Cicchetti's.
There were no prints of either Hunter or Cicchetti. The only prints that were found were those of Evelyn and Larry, and they were on a whiskey bottle. And her testimony was that after the 2 men had beaten up Jones, Cicchetti asked her to get him a drink, and she handed him the bottle of whiskey. But there are no prints found.
Did
and nobody saw them. No neighbors saw them.
Did Sacchetti's counsel emphasize that point as part of his defense?
Defense? Well, if he did, it wasn't enough because it didn't convince the jury, but I don't recall that he did.
How long, Ray, did the trial last?
I'm going to shut that off. I can tell you. About 3 weeks.
Let me indicate for the record at this time that we have a Times photograph of the courtroom in session, showing a packed courtroom, and showing Ray sitting at the press table. Ray, I think it might be helpful here to put on record some background about Judge Gillis, who was certainly a colorful character in McCoy's court.
He was then in his 50s. He had played football for several universities. He was from old city in New England. I think it was Worcester, Massachusetts. And he played football for several colleges around the East. And this was when the eligibility rules used to be winked at. And he was... then he came to the University of Detroit and played football there. Graduated in law school and practiced law for a while in Detroit and got an appointment to Common Pleas Court. From Common Pleas Court, he went to, by another appointment, to Recorder's Court. And he was elected term after term to be courted. Now, he took, usually, he, of course, he denied this, but he usually acted anti-police in the courtroom. He would often ridicule the police, bawl them out. They hated to go in his courtroom. And he thought a lot of the things they did were dishonest, as their testimony. And he thought that they were not to be trusted in their version of what of the evidence they presented him. And this wasn't always, but this was often, which made him popular with a large number of Detroiters, and he didn't have much trouble getting reelected. He was erratic. His sentences could be unbelievably light or unbelievably extreme, and no one quite knew just how he'd arrive at them.
He also had the weakness, as the Irish say.
Well, he drank a bit. Never on the bench. Never during working hours.
Didn't that get him into trouble on a few celebrated occasions?
Well, he was arrested for some kind of an affair in Canada. I understood he couldn't go back there. And he was arrested in Oakland County for being drunk and disorderly and breaking up a pinball machine. He was arrested, I believe, in Highland Park. But it was always over drink. It was never anything serious. And I think he was convicted of these misdemeanors. However, just didn't keep him from getting elected. And I personally thought he contributed greatly to Recorder's Court, because I always felt that a person had a very fair chance in his court if that person were friendless and without funds. They could get justice. He was controversial. Very controversial.
You came to his aid on one occasion.
Well, the time I went out, the time he was arrested in Oakland County, they locked him up in the county jail, and he was to be arraigned in the morning. So I heard about it when I went in my office that morning and said, I think I'd go out and cheer him up. So I rode out there. He was still in jail. He hadn't been arraigned yet. And I went with him to his arraignment, and this was a misdemeanor. Some old country judge who'd come in to Pontiac, who was just working there temporarily, come in from the sticks, he pleaded not guilty, and he put a $250 bond on him for disorderly. You know, which is a very, really minor misdemeanor. I go, if I guess, and they had a penny with him. And I happen to have 200, so he always called me, 250, so, with me. So he always referred to me as his bondsman after that. But it was a ridiculous bond, and I was glad I had the money with him to put up, or he'd been another trip back to Detroit to get it. Incidentally, he sent it back to me that afternoon.
Getting back to Sacchetti, the thought occurs that he might have created this disorder in Jackson in order to be transferred to Marquette. Do you think there's anything to that?
No, I don't think so. He was... I really don't. If that was in the back of his mind, he got much more than he bargained for, because this developed into quite a slugging match with the guards and inmates, and his arm was broken, and he was pretty badly battered, and eventually was at the Marquette. I don't know. It's very hard to divine the mental workings of a person like that. The vagaries of the human mind are difficult at best but with a person who's been scuffling all his life, beating people and figuring angles, of course, it's very possible.
What kind of prisoner was Hunter?
Hunter had to be kept out of the general population for a while, but then he calmed down and became a model prisoner, and was teaching classes, and he seemed to get a great satisfaction out of the work he was doing teaching. I say that because in the letters I had from him, he always talked to me about that work and about how he was helping other inmates. And he knew that he was having some good effect, because after they'd be released from prison, they'd write to him. And he knew they're getting it wrong.
Did we indicate that... Evelyn Larry's children were returned to her?
Yes,
after she was married.
After she was married. Yeah.
Ray, you have more to add about the relationship between Sacchetti and Evelyn.
Well, jealousy and the hate was immense. The jealousy over, I'm sure, over Hunter. And I'm not suggesting that there's any conscious homosexual feeling or relationship between the two men. I don't think there was at all, at least conscious. But Sacchetti resented Evelyn terribly. And he told Hunter stories about her that I, and told me that he told them. And I rather doubted them, but they were the kind of stories that would tend to turn a man against a woman. Vicious stories. But apparently it didn't work, because Hunter and Sacchetti Hunter and Evelyn were together right up to the time they were arrested in Chicago. So he didn't succeed in splitting them up.
Of course, she ceased being under Hunter's nomination from the moment of her arrest.
Yeah, that's true. But she was, they were still, you know, living together until that time. From then on, well, I think from then on it was, after she was arrested, it was a case of trying to save herself, too. She didn't want to be convicted of murder, and she understood. She might not have been, her IQ might not have, you know, might have been lacking a bit. But she was certainly smart enough to understand the jam she was in. And she cooperated without much. First, it didn't take an awful lot of persuasion on my part. She told me the story first, of course, but and it took a while to get her going. But it wasn't the toughest job I ever had. She, after a couple of hours beating around the bush, hinting at things, persuading, it just, the floodgates opened, and she told me the whole story. And it's the same story she told on the witness stand. She didn't change it.
Ray, this case was featured on a popular radio program of the era. Big story, was it?
Oh, yes, Brownell Cigarettes Radio, and then on television by the same people. And then in a magazine that they printed called A Big Story. I thought they never let go of that one, but there are some rewards to it, I think. $500 for this and $500 for the radio, $500 for the television, and $250, I think, for the magazine piece. That was a popular radio program. And you know, in the last days of radio. And then it went pretty good on television for a while. It was discontinued.
What was the format of that program?
Newspaper. It was called A Big Story. And everyone was, what a newspaper man did, that was unusual. And that, it just followed it the way we've been talking. Except they made it, they dramatized it, and used a lot of, you know, dialogue that sounded a little like Third Street melodrama.
Do you recall whether any other Detroit newsmen had stories featured?
I think, it seems to me that one, I'm not sure. It seems to me that either Ralph Nelson or Ken McCormick had a story, but I'm not sure. Don't recall. I'm not positive.
The Times, however, by reason of your coverage, sort of put its stamp on this story, didn't it?
Well, I think we felt a proprietary interest in it because we were ahead in the story all the way through, even in the trial. We managed to stay ahead of the opposition, not every day, but frequently, because Well, hell, I knew everybody. It would be easy, for instance, to know that a witness coming over from Chicago might have changed his mind, be reluctant to come over because he hadn't been subpoenaed or something, and that would be straight enough. There are many things that would happen on a day-to-day basis that would make give a new angle to the story.
Did we mention, Ray, that this may have been the only case that Gerald O'Brien personally tried as prosecutor?
Best of my recollection, it is. The only one he tried. And he's prosecutor a long time. And it was rarely that Garber went to court, too. But the publicity connected with this was too tempting for any prosecutor to stay away from. So Jerry having to run for election, I assume that's why he went to court. Now, of course, he was in a long time. I may be wrong on that. He might have gone in on, some other thing, but I'm sure that's the only case, just about positive, that's the only case he ever tried.
Perhaps we should say something about Sid Sherman, who's been around the criminal courts a long time.
Well, he is a very skillful defense lawyer and has been around the criminal courts for at least 30 years, I'd say, maybe longer, but in this trial, he represented Hunter, and I don't think Clarence Darrow and all the great criminal lawyers who ever lived could have done much for him because he was just impossible to control, among other things. And Sherman did a good job. About the best he could do was try the case for the record and make a record so that he could get a new trial at a later date, which he succeeded in doing. I think it was impossible to get his client acquitted during that trial.
Considering the evidence as it developed, the thought occurs that had the Miranda warning requirements been in operation at that time, there would have been no case whatever against any of the defendants.
I think not.
Unless Larry had chosen not to.
Unless that one's Evelyn Larry's hate for Cicchetti was so great that she would have changed it around a bit. Of course, she protected herself as best she could. She was just going out. They weren't supposed to get out of the cab, according to her. And she was just going to see him for a couple of minutes. They came in, did everything. She pleaded with them not to. Now, she could have been asked a lot of questions, of course, as to why she didn't tell the police about it. And why she went back. Her answer would have been, knowing her, that she was afraid. But she didn't. And I'm inclined to think that if she understood what her rights were under Miranda, that she wouldn't have said anything. And as far as building a case otherwise, I don't know just how it could have been done because we knew pretty well, eventually knew pretty well what happened. But there wasn't anybody to tell the jury that.